This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 22 for April 21st, 2011. It's a Thursday night, and we're out here podcasting again, and I want to welcome all the visitors on Ustream and thank all those folks as well that are out there and have downloaded the podcast to the show. I am your host, Jim Collison, and tonight I have a couple guys with me, some Home Server Show guys that have come out. The regulars are all gone. Christian has made his way to Argentina and is doing well down there, and I'm a little jealous that he's down there and I'm not. Andrew came down with a cold, not really, but he's not feeling well tonight, so he took the night off. But so tonight I have Mike Howard. Mike joined us last week, and so Mike, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Jim. Good. Glad to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. I'm glad you could fill in. You're actually filling in for Christian. And I did try and get John to fill in for Andrew, but I couldn't get him tonight. He must be out. So welcome and thanks, Mike. I also have Rich O'Neill. Rich is known as DVN in the Home Server Show forum and does a lot of work and a lot of posts out there at the Home Server Show. Rich, welcome back to the Home Tech Podcast.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, you bet. Glad to have both of you guys out here tonight. We've got a packed show, a lot of content and a lot of information, so hold on tight. We're gonna roll through this stuff fairly quickly. I want to let you know, though, first that if you want to contact the show, you can reach me, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. And I've been getting a few emails over the last couple weeks, so I appreciate any comments that you might have. Out there at theaverageguy.tv, we have all the links for iTunes and RSS feeds as well. So if you want to automatically download the podcast each week, all the links are available right there on the right-hand side. You can also listen to the podcast live on The Average Guy if you want to do that as well. And just a reminder, if you're a Facebooker and you want to know when the various podcasts come out, you can go up in the search bar and type in The Average Guy Network, and you'll find us, and you can just ask for permissions to join the page, and I'll let you in. And then that'll notify you of new podcasts that come out each and every week. Speaking of Facebook, I don't know if you guys knew this, and it's not in the show notes, but Facebook did this weird thing this week where they changed their default security settings for everybody and didn't tell anybody. And then, so for example, I serve Facebook in an HTTPS, right, in a secure mode, so that, I don't know, maybe I'm paranoid, but that's what I like. And in my security permissions, I had that checked. So anytime I go to Facebook with my profile, it would automatically create that secure HTTP session for me. And Facebook, without ever telling anybody or asking anybody, changed all those defaults for everybody. Wow. And if you have your set to secure and you haven't checked it, you might want to go out and check your Facebook profile and make sure that secure setting is set. So, guys, we're going to talk a little bit about security tonight, but that's kind of a big deal to change default security settings and then not warn the users, don't you think, Mike?
Absolutely, yeah. I guess I've never used that. I don't have anything over there I care about, and I don't go there that often. But, yeah, if you're going to change the security settings, you've got to let people know.
Now, do you think they did that because of what was it, FireShape? Is that what it was called?
Oh, the Firefox plugin that.
Yeah, that I think it's called FireShape.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
And it's a vulnerability where somebody can be sitting in an open hotspot, unsecured, no password kind of a thing, and they can be running a program. They can see you log in, and they can actually hijack your session and log in as you on Facebook.
Right.
So
now, certainly, Facebook responded to that vulnerability by creating or allowing you to change your profile settings to HTTPS when you log in automatically. I honestly think what happened is they made an update to that service of some kind and probably didn't test it all the way or didn't know that when they deployed it, it would automatically change everybody's security settings back. Probably just one of those QA things that they missed. That's a pretty big QA miss if that's the case.
And why would someone want to steal your Facebook account to send out spam or just
make
your friends mad at you?
Nah, some people probably keep information in there that's sensitive of some kind. I mean, not all of us keep everything there, but you never know. Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe phone numbers or something like that.
Yeah, I just like it because it's a privacy thing. And so if I can be more private than less private, I'll choose the more private option.
Sure.
In that case. So anyways, I was just reminded of that. I was looking at something else, and I thought, oh, yeah, that happened this week. I saw that on Facebook. A lot of people were posting that vulnerability out there. So if you're a Facebook user and you had that checked, you probably should go back and look at it again. If you've never done that before, it's really simple. It's in your profile under security settings. And you can check that, and on any computer you're in, it will invoke the secure HTTP. And all that really means, if you don't know, is that you're coming across a secure connection and no one can snoop on the line. So good, I think a good thing to do for Facebook and really any site, especially your email. If you're still using some public email and some of that public stuff doesn't use HTTPS, be concerned about what you transfer to and fro on that unsecure line. So.
Yeah, that's a good thing. When we're done here, I'm going to go secure my Facebook account.
There you go. There you go. Guys, this week, a couple of quick announcements. One, Office 360 for Microsoft came out this week. And I don't know if you guys have seen that offering from them, but it is basically, you know, Office and email. You know, it's Office and Exchange and SharePoint all in the cloud. And so I've seen some demos of it. It works fairly well. This is their kind of competition for Google Apps in some way. It is not free. It's going to be $6. It starts at $6 a user. You know, if you're a small business and you've got 10 employees, it's $60 a month. Let's say $60 to $100 a month, or you know, $1,200 a year. Certainly for an office of 10, that might be a whole bunch cheaper than having an Exchange server, trying to set up SharePoint, and you know, managing all the email as well as all the Office web apps. Mike, certainly you've got a large organization,
right?
$6, that gets a little pricey in a larger organization. Of course, I bet it gets cheaper as the organizations get larger.
True. I just signed up for the beta. I think the beta is free, right?
Yeah, and I should say it is a public beta. Sorry, I made it sound like that was in production. But, the public beta, which in Microsoft, it might as well be production these days.
Right.
They don't release a beta unless it's kind of fully baked.
So, I signed up for the beta. I want to give it a test. I think I mentioned before the IT folks don't report to me in our organization. But we do work well together. So I want to give it a check and see. And see what it's all about.
Yeah, Rich or Mike, let me ask you, Rich, do you use any online documentation like Google Docs? I know we do the show notes in Google Docs. But
yeah, this is actually the first time I've ever used Google Docs with you.
Yeah.
And I've been meaning to, wanting to try it, but I just never found an occasion to do it. So I think it's pretty cool. Actually.
So I gave you a good excuse to go out there and give it a try.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I cannot.
And I've told other people about it, you know.
From a podcasting standpoint, it's just changed the game. The ability for the three of us to view our show documents or our show doc that we have, just one doc out there, we all share it. I can see what you guys are typing in real time. There's a cursor there that has your name by it if you're typing. I mean, it's as good as it gets, I think, for this kind of application. I've never been a huge fan of sharing of the collaboration at work that way. I've never felt like that would work very well.
I don't think it is either. And I think with what I've seen with most of these things is they're more lightweight apps. You know, I wouldn't do any hit. I looked at the Excel version of the Google Docs, and it's for a power user, it's not going to be enough.
Yeah.
You know, for lightweight use,
yeah,
it's fine. For power users, it won't be good enough.
Yeah, Rich, if you needed an email solution and it was just you, would you pay $6 a month to get email and maybe all the Office web apps at home if it was just you?
No, I wouldn't. Okay. I don't have the need for that.
Yeah, do you have a TechNet subscription, Rich?
Actually, Mike and I were just talking about it. Somebody from one of their subscription services just called me up the other day while I was at work and renewed me right then.
Oh, really? Yours had come up for renewal.
Yeah.
Mine's up for renewal too. That's what I was showing. Okay,
yeah, I figured. I got that same letter, by the way, Mike. Of course, with the MVP, mine will extend beyond that. But so the three of us aren't good candidates for this because we get all the Office software free and we can connect to the web apps for free as well. So we're probably not great candidates. Just an interesting thing that's out there on this Office 360. Microsoft has not pushed it very hard. It'll be interesting to see if they push it very hard when it goes live.
Yeah, I think for the average user who's not a power user, you know, the Google Docs or this Office 365 is a good thing to look into. You know, how many people are going to need to create, you know, massive involved pivot tables and slicers and all that kind of stuff? I mean, that's more the advanced user who's going to want all that on his local machine.
Yeah, no. I think for the small business, this is a pretty good deal. I've seen small offices try and set up their own Exchange and trying to set up their own. I mean, SharePoint's not as common in that space, but this gets you Office web apps. It gets you the Exchange availability. You can do Outlook through hosted Exchange, websites and collaboration through SharePoint, IM and online meetings, and they guarantee 99.9% uptime. So, it's something to look at. And so if you're a small business owner, maybe you work from home as well, the beta is open. It's free at this point. So give that a try. And I think you can just go to Microsoft.com and search for Office 365. I want to call it 360. I don't know. I think I called it that when I first started. But
yeah, I say it too.
Yeah. For whatever reason, I want to call it 360. In some news this week, it looks like Seagate is going to purchase the Samsung's hard drive division for like $1.37 billion. We had been talking about Samsung drives a couple weeks ago. Christian brought that up. That was actually his pick of the week, his deal of the week. And Samsung makes a pretty good hard drive. Seagate maybe doesn't make as good of a hard drive. I think that's just my own personal opinion. And then of course Hitachi was bought by Western Digital just a couple weeks back for about $4 billion. Boy, the money is spreading around. There are not many hard drive manufacturers left. Guys, are we consolidating to the point where we may see a downturn in the, you know, because whenever consolidation happens, it seems like quality goes down. I don't know. That's my opinion.
Quality goes down, price goes up. Yep.
That's,
I agree.
That's my opinion. Are we getting too consolidated in this, or could we be getting too consolidated in this market?
So who do we have left? We have Western Digital and
Western Digital,
Seagate,
and I'm sure there's a few other small manufacturers back there, but Seagate and Western Digital are going to dominate for sure at this point, being number one and number two. I'm sure there's some off brands that do a few things there, but there aren't many left.
I don't. Maybe it's just me, but it seems like I like to have three strong players. Two makes me think of American Visa, MasterCard.
There you go. But it always seems like it consolidates, right? Apple and Droid, right, at this point.
It does.
And so it just always seems like it gets down to two. Rich, do you have a preferred hard drive vendor that you use for your equipment?
You know, for a while I did. You know, it was Western Digital. But, you know, I don't really – you know, I really don't think that anybody's got a lock on, you know, the perfect drive every time for every model. So what I basically do is I do what a lot of people do. I look at the eggs on Newegg, and I look at Passmark's benchmarks site to see how a drive is rated, and then I see what it costs, and I try to figure out what I want to buy from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever shop just pure cost, cheapest drive?
I have, you know, and I've bought some of these drives, and, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, I've got a couple of green Western Digitals in my server, and I took one out because it was just a backup drive for the server, but it keeps having a problem with, pending sector count or pending sector reallocation count, and, you know, I don't know. I think I've heard that basically these hard drives aren't the same quality as the better hard drives. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that they're green is because you spin them lower at a lower speed and you put them to sleep more often, they may last longer.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, it makes sense to me. It can't be as good a quality as something that costs twice as much. So something's there.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my Unraid server right now, and I've got a mix of Hitachi, Seagate, Samsung, and Western Digital.
Okay.
And so I somewhat regret buying the cheapest, because that's been sort of what I've done over the past, is bought the cheapest. And as I built this Unraid server, I've got a mix of 7200, 5400, and I think even a 5900 RPM drive in there. And I'm starting to regret all those 5900 drives. Because Unraid works sort of like a RAID. It's got a parity, and whichever drive is the slowest is going to dictate the speed of the transfer.
Right.
And now I've got all these 5400 drives in there, and it's just slowing down. For a while, I had my parity drive as a 5400 drive, so everything was just too slow. So I'm starting to buy more Western Digital, actually.
And when I did the Drobo review, and they sent me all Western Digital drives. That's all I've got. And I'm out at a Newegg page right now with internal drives, looking at them, and it's Seagate, 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 Western Digital, Western Digital, Western Digital. You know, and then there's a Hitachi thrown in there, and a little Samsung thrown in there. But certainly, there's 18 pages of hard drives, and as I look at them, most of them are Western Digital or Seagate, so they've kind of cornered that market for sure. It'll be interesting. I'll be honest with you guys. 10 years from now, I think we're going to chuckle about spinning hard drives.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm about to build a RAID 0 drive for my data drive out of two Western Digital black drives. Mm-hmm. And the Western Digital blacks have always been fairly expensive, but I was looking on Newegg this week, and the 1.5 terabyte was $109, which is not really bad for – Not bad for Western Digital Black.
Yeah, I have some question as to whether they consistently use the same, are up to the same quality throughout the same model, over a period of time in manufacturing.
Yeah. Well, I think that would be a great question. And you'd mentioned you checked the reviews. I think that's probably the only way to know what the current quality of these drives are, is to kind of get a feeling from the community on what they're saying about that. So,
and Newegg does an excellent job of that.
Yeah, they sure do. Well, speaking of hard drives, Rich, I know you've done a little bit of work this week. It's easy to go buy the hard drive and slap it in your PC for the most part and put data on it. But from time to time, folks want to get rid of that data. And that's become in the era of SOX and NIST and all these other government things, and with some of the banking, with people losing data, certainly a lot of attention has been put on the fact of how do you get rid of the data. In fact, some companies buy hard drive crushers, that they can throw the drive in and it physically crushes the drive to dust. I think the government has some kind of
shredder. Yeah.
Yeah. Some kind of hard drive. I know. And I don't know this for sure, but I've heard in some of the top secret aircraft stuff, they actually, if the plane is going down, people are pulling drives and jamming those in devices that kind of obliterate them, so that you can't ever get anything off. But, Rich, say I'm the average user, right? I've got some information on the drive. It's Microsoft Money save file, or it's a Quicken file, or it's whatever, right? And I want to make sure I really get that off my drive before I sell it. Talk a little bit about that topic for me, and tell me what I could do.
Well, okay, yeah. There has been a lot of talk about hard drive disposal, how to securely delete your data, and there's different ways to go about it, and maybe what you're doing is you're just going to throw a hard drive away. And, maybe what you're going to do is turn around and give it to one of your kids. So you don't really want any of your personal data on there. You can't do something simple like a simple partition delete or a format or both. Because, if your kid is one of these inquisitive, ingenuitive type, ingenious types, he'll go on the internet, he'll find some file partition recovery, undelete, utility, and he'll be looking at all your files. So that's really not the way to go. The way to go, and most people who are even thinking about this probably know that you want to overwrite your data. So what people will typically do is they'll find a utility like dband, or they might use CCleaner or something like KillDisk, or a bunch of other utilities that basically provide about the same functionality and the same level of security sanitization. So you might like select dband to use because it's easy to use and it's effective. You just download and burn an ISO, and you boot up with the CD in the drive and select the hard drive you want to erase, and a wipe method, that is how many passes and what kind of data you're going to write to it, and then hit F10 and run it. So that's pretty easy. Now, I'm kind of paraphrasing this, but the the DoD considers D-band secure enough for repurposing a hard drive within their organization. So if, you know, if you're leaving, you're going to another position, they might take your hard drive and run D-band on it, and then they'll turn around and put it in a machine and give it to Mike. So that's, you know, that's maybe a purpose that the DoD is comfortable with. And I believe that they consider a D-band pass to be good for data up to, is it secret, I believe? I think it is. Anyway, but it's definitely, you know, when you get to the point of, when talking about the DoD for a second here, when they get to the point where they've got secret data or anything above that, what they actually do is they call for the drive to be physically destroyed by shredding it, or to use a magnet on it, a degaussing device on it. So basically, those are two ways. Those are two ways that are probably not going to be used by typical people like you and me. You know, we're going to probably stick with something like a D-band or some other similar utility. You know, one, simply because, you know, if you're thinking about using the hard drive again, you know, you may not have access to a shredder, but you might think about maybe you could find a degausser. The problem with that is that if you run a degausser up against the hard drive, it wipes your data, sure, but it also wipes the firmware of the hard drive, which is basically the little operating system for the hard drive. So that hard drive is just junk. It's totally useless, and you can't hand it down to anybody. So... I was thinking about this, and you know, there's been a lot of talk in the forums about this, and you know, how many overwrites does it take, and what kind of data? You know, what kind of data are we writing? Are we writing zeros? Are we writing ones? Are we writing zeros and ones, and then a random data pass, and then repeat that a couple of times? And I got to tell you, it's a time-consuming process when you run that many passes over a hard drive. And I've been listening to this one guy on his podcast called My Hard Drive Died, and that's also the name of his website. The guy's name is Scott Moulton, and he's our hard drive recovery and forensic expert who's been working with hard drive for years. And basically what he says, I mean, I've heard him say it a couple of times, but I heard him most recently on his latest podcast say, one pass. And, you know, for him anyway, he's saying one pass, and that you can virtually consider it impossible to recover that data. Now, I know there's a lot of people who will say, well, you know, we can get these microscopes, these magnetic force microscopes, I believe they're called. And we can look at the edge of the tracks, you know. Well, that may or may not be. But there's actually, you know, as I was researching this, I was looking at what people are using and what they're not using. And one of the most interesting file overwrite utilities that people aren't using is actually this utility that I've talked about before on another podcast called Secure Erase. And Secure Erase is actually part of the ATA command set, which is the set of commands that controls your hard drive and allows a host system, you know, Windows, to control your hard drive. And basically, the Secure Erase, what it does is it talks internally to the hard drive. So there's a couple advantages to using Secure Erase. One is it bypasses BIOS. It doesn't talk to BIOS, you know, to talk to your hard drive. It doesn't go through BIOS to talk to your hard drive. It talks directly to your hard drive. So you have a utility like D-band. It goes through BIOS. So it's slower because BIOS is, you know, the middleman. Think about BIOS and how slow that is. So the claim is with Secure Erase is that it's 8 times faster than D-band. And I got excited about that. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, let's test this. So I grabbed a 320 gig hard drive and I set up Secure Erase and I timed it. And it wiped that drive in 45 minutes. So then I redid the setup. I threw in a D-band ISO CD and booted up. And I selected, I don't know what the default D-band pass is. I think it's a 3-pass overwrite. But I selected a single pass, writing all zeros with D-band. And yeah, it actually took 89 minutes, so effectively twice as long as Secure Erase to wipe that drive. So, that's one for Secure Erase. So you start to think, well, why aren't people using Secure Erase? Because, time is money. We got better things to do with our life than sit around and watch D-band work, So I was doing some research and back to the whole idea of maybe some data remnants on the edge of the tracks, Well, the people that developed Secure Erase, that spec, came up with a second Secure Erase called Enhanced Secure Erase. And this is pretty cool because what it does is it uses an internal ATA command to offset the track, the head, the read-write head, to offset it about 5 to 10% to one side or the other of the track. So effectively, it's got one wheel in the, in the ditch as it's riding along. So it's wiping out the edge of the track as it makes a pass one way, and then they have a second pass, and that's a Secure Erase pass. So it comes down the other side of the track, and it effectively wipes everything out from the middle on out to the over the edge, So with a utility like that, You wonder why people wouldn't use that, because really, right there, if you're running over your data track like that, you're not going to be able to recover. I mean, you and I aren't. No guy at Best Buy is going to. And Scott Moulton says that he can't do it. And he's an expert. So, debatable as to whether the government could do it or not. I'm not going to even get into that debate. Personally, I will tell you, I don't think it's possible. But doesn't matter. I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
Right. So I just think it's, I think it's an interesting thing to use. I was going to tell you why people probably don't use this thing more often. It's hard to work with. It's a little bit hard to work with. First of all, when they did this spec up and put it in, they also decided that BIOSes would lock out this command from running upon boot up. So when your motherboard boots up, it sends this command to the hard drive. It's called a security freeze command. And so you boot up, and you've got your secure erase utility in your drive bay, and you go to start it up and it says, hey, you can't run. You're locked out. Do you want to run some other kind of utility? So I found there's a couple of ways to get around this. And one is sometimes what you can do is simply power down, pull the plug on the SATA connector to your motherboard and plug it in something other than SATA zero. And that might get you in, sure. Or the other thing to do, which is a little more dicey, although some people think it's a little more dicey. I don't, because of the way SATA plugs are designed. They're designed to make contact. The pins are staggered inside the plug, so they're designed to make contact with the ground before they actually make hot connections. So what the second way to do is to boot up, get past the hardware detection phase of BIOS, and then plug your drive, power your drive back up. And when you do that, and I've done it, and I can confirm it works, you're able to run your Secure Erase utility.
Is that something I could use? So if I had an external hard drive dock, and I bought one of those for like $30 to be able to, people would bring their hard drives to me all the time and say, I can't get anything off of this, or it crashed, right? And it was just easier for me to throw it in the dock and use my instance of Windows to get to it. So I could have this SE version, this enhanced SE version running. I assume it's a Windows utility.
No, it's actually a command built in to the ATA set of commands.
Right. So how do I get
to it? So you would use some kind of the way I get to it, okay, is I use a ISO called a CD called Parted Magic.
Okay.
And it's one of these utility, boot utility kind of ISOs where you can check network connections, all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
And one of the things you can do is you can run secure erase. You can run four or five different kind of erasures on a hard drive, and one of them is secure erase. So you run it that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe a little more complex for the average user and trying that, but certainly not all that difficult to do.
Yeah, well, it's not that difficult to do, but you're right. It's a little more complex.
Yeah.
So what's another incentive to do it? Well, the other incentive to do it is that if you really do want to make sure all your data's gone off the hard drive, D-Band will not do that for you, and other typical block erase utilities won't. There may be some others besides Secure Erase today that can do it, but I will tell you the difference is that Secure Erase can get to the actual bad block list. So the G list, the grown list, right, of bad blocks. And it can also get to your HPA, host protected areas, and your device configuration overlays areas. These are places that D-Band can't get to, cannot get to. So, the HPAs and the DCOs, maybe they're not so much of a concern. But, I mean, you know, when you have a bad block, it doesn't mean that the block is physically no good. It just means that maybe Windows got tired. There's a timeout for Windows, and I think it tries for somebody can correct me on this, but I think it's like 600, milliseconds before it says, "Oh, you're taking too long. Reallocate you. Get another block in here. Let's go."
Sure.
Right. So, so the point is that that could have been a sector that Windows couldn't read,
right,
but has data on it, and somebody else using some kind of Linux-based recovery, hex editor could read that part, that sector. So, those are sectors that DBAM won't touch.
Rich, is this you're talking about when you're going to sell a hard drive, not when you're just getting rid of one? For instance, if I've got I've got some drives behind me that are 40 gig, probably a 100 meg drive that I have no use for, and I'm just going to drill a hole through it with my drill and toss it in the trash.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike,
I think that's personally, I think that's safe. I mean, anybody that wants to get data off you must have done something really bad, Mike. If somebody wants to spend, right?
Nobody wants anything off that drive.
Nobody wants to see your data, Mike. I mean, if you really did something that bad, you're in the news and everybody knows about you. You're going to jail anyway, so forget it. You know, if you drill a hole through it, fine. But not everybody has a drill press. So a pretty easy way. And it's once you figure it out, once you get your routine down. And my routine is just basically, pop in Parted Magic. And boot up, and basically now what I do is I just don't even bother to connect the drive until I'm up and running with Parted Magic, and then I just connect the drive, put the power connector in there, and I'm good.
Now, obviously, if you're going to give the drive to a friend or sell it, drilling a hole through it's not going to be the best plan.
That's not a good idea.
Yeah,
they won't be laughing. Yeah.
I think a lot of people have a misconception that formatting the drive, because they can't get to the data anymore, but the data's gone.
Well, I used to.
From my experience, I know the people can't see it, but I have these little compact flash cards I use in my camera. And, how many times have I gone through, downloaded the photos, formatted the card? I could format the card 100 times in writing stuff to it. And then somewhere along the line, I have a problem and some of my files are corrupted. And I use a program called Photo Rescue to get the photos off of there. And lo and behold, here's a photo from a year ago. I have formatted this thing 100 times since then.
Yeah, that blows my mind. Yeah.
But it is pulling a file off there. And you got to think, if that's happening on this little compact flash card with 100 formats on it, that your formatting of your hard drive is not getting rid of what you think it's getting rid of.
Yeah.
Well, and you see why Best Buy, if you turn in your PC for recycle, right, Best Buy here in the United States takes your PC. They'll take up to 3 items per day from you. At least that was the case a couple months ago, to recycle. But they won't take your PC with the hard drive. And you can see why. I mean, that's
right.
Kind of a lawsuit. Much. There's too much liability there for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, good, Rich. That does give us some if you are worried about that, right? That's kind of the way to do it. That's probably the most secure way for the average guy to be able to pull this off, right? There's probably other secret security stuff that the government does or the government has, and maybe not. But in your opinion, this is a really good secure way to make sure that drive is all that data is erased and it has been removed off the drive.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talk a lot of theory about how, you know, maybe they could look right at the data and like see like shadows in the data or, you know, the tracks. But, you know, this is something that they were able to do with a tiny bit of success years ago when hard drive density. Well, I mean, my first hard drive was a 2.1 gigabyte Samsung, same size platters. Nowhere near the data, you know, amount of data on that drive. So possibly years ago they could have done it. Today, I'm going to go with what this guy, this expert says, and it's, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's impossible.
I think you do need to take some steps, you know, before you give that hard drive to a friend or sell it or whatever. You know, who knows what was on there before? Your Quicken files, your, you know, some spreadsheets. Right. You know, if you're like me, you have a spreadsheet with a lot of information on it about different accounts and stuff like that. If anything were to happen to me, you know, my wife can find all the account numbers and all that. Well, I'd hate for that to fall into the wrong hands. So definitely don't just format it and hand it over to a friend.
Yeah, and I don't know about you guys, but I use my drives till they're just absolute dust. You know, and I've got a bunch stacked in the garage. I should probably go through and throw those in my dock and get them erased, or just drill holes in them and throw them in scrap metal for recycling.
The fact that I have a 100 meg drive sitting behind me tells you that I haven't.
No, I got some 80 gig drives out in the garage.
100 meg.
Oh, you got 100 meg.
Oh my God, that is old.
Yes.
How old is that thing? You should keep it.
Yeah, I need to just throw it away. Drill a hole in it.
Did you ever see those? Have you ever seen they have a kit that you can buy? If you take the hard drive apart and leave the platters in it, you can drill a hole through the center of the platters and then put this clock enclosure, right? So it's the hands for the clock, and all the mechanism sits inside the hard drive spindle then. And the power comes out the back, right? And so you basically turn this hard drive, these platters, the round platter, into the clock. And it's really kind of cool.
That is not DOD approved, I guess.
I have a guy that works for me who has one of the platters taped to his monitor. And, of course, he says it so he can see people coming up behind him. I think he likes to fix his hair all throughout the day.
There you go. Yeah. Well, and those things, my kids used to take them apart and pull the magnets out of them.
Yeah,
because those magnets on the rocker arms are just super, super strong, and so they'd pull them out and stick them to everything in the house. And after that, and then they leave the garage a mess because they, you know, pull these hard drives apart. I said, no more pulling hard drives apart. Although that effectively ruins the drive. So maybe that's a way to do it as well. So, well, Rich, thanks for that and working us through the hard drive. Any other thoughts, Rich, before we close that up?
Nope, that's about it. Just, you know, if your data is important to you and you don't want anybody touching it, at least deban it and think about Secure Erase if you can deal with it.
And that Secure Erase is freeware, right?
Yeah, no, it's an ATA command.
Oh,
it's actually part of every hard drive built since 2001.
Just has it on there.
Has this capability. So you can call it. You just can't call it from Windows.
Right. Yeah. You got to go through the steps. Well, we'll put some links out there to help folks out with that and get some better understanding. If you want to go out and try that, we'll put a link out there to help you out with that. Well, good. Appreciate that, Rich.
Sure.
Mike, you had you talked about a little bit, and we talk a lot about SyncToy, especially when we talk home server stuff, because we're always moving data around between PCs and the home server or off the home server or between home servers and stuff like that. But you recently looked at another application called Always Sync.
Right.
And you compared the two. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, my problem is that I have my Windows Home Server as a VM inside my Hyper-V server. And because of that, I'm limited to the 2 terabyte. I can't set up a RAID array and get beyond the 2 terabyte. So when I start backing up all my PCs, I'm going to go well beyond the 2 terabyte. And I know that for a lot of people, that sounds unusual. You know, if you just got a bunch of PCs in the house, why are you going beyond the 2 terabyte? And that's really because of me. At first, I thought it was my kids, but it was me. I've got almost 1.5 terabytes of photos. I've got a crazy number of photos. I looked at the file the other day, and I think I have well over 200,000 photos, and then all the sidecar files that go along with that, and you add all those things up. It was over 800,000 files adding up to about 1.5 terabytes. So me alone, just with that, was going to come close to using up all my storage space on the Windows Home server. So, you know, one solution was to put all that, I think PC Doc recommended, why don't you put all that on a network share? Well, if you ever use Lightroom and deal with your photos quite a bit, working over the network is not going to be good enough. And I have, you know, even my hard drive here is just not fast enough. So I want to leave it on my local server, but I need to get those things backed up. I do have them backed up with CrashPlan offsite, but I have an Unraid server in the house and I want to back them up to my Unraid server. So I was using SyncToy and set up a Windows scheduled event to every night at 3 o'clock, go out there and sync the two. And that worked fine. And then PC Doc had mentioned something about Always Sync. So I downloaded that, gave that a try. And if you have a smaller number of files, it's great. It gives you a much better graphical view of what you got. It's got on one side of the screen, it's got your local storage. On the other side, it's got where you're backing it up to, where you're syncing it to. So it shows you, here's the files on both cases and which ones are different. It's very, I like it from that standpoint a whole lot better than SyncToy. The problem I'm running into is that because I have so many files, Always Sync is using somewhere in over 2 gig of RAM, and it's starting to,
oh wow,
it's starting to really use up a lot of my resources. So I'm still working with it, but I'm considering going back to SyncToy and just setting that up as a scheduled event to happen in the middle of the night.
So if folks want to take a peek at that, that's really just Always Sync, all one word, SYNC, sorry, ALLWAYSYNC.com. And so it's physically holding those files that it's syncing in RAM. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think what's happened, this could be I've just set things up wrong. I'm still playing with it, but I have told it to look for changes. Anytime there's a change to a file inside that directory, and the way it's looking at, to back it up, to sync it to my Unraid server or to wherever you'd want to sync it to. So, you know, maybe if you had it set up as a scheduled event where it would just go through and do its thing and then get rid of itself, then it would be good. But I like seeing it all there. And I'm also toying now with, all right, rather than giving it the entire drive, because I have one folder that says photos. And underneath that, I have tons of breakouts. So rather than just giving it the header directory, why not go and give it individual directories? So I'm playing with that. But even with that, I'm getting a large amount of RAM being used.
Okay. That's interesting. And does it have a scheduler built into it then?
It does. You know, okay. I am using have it happen every time something's written to it, but you can also schedule it. And you can schedule it through the Windows scheduler too.
Okay. And I'll be honest, I have not liked using Windows scheduler. I don't know why. I'm just adverse to it. Maybe I used it once and it didn't work real well or something. And I know that's easy, but that's the one big drawback to SyncToy is that it won't schedule. So I don't use it for that, but
yeah, but it's so easy to schedule.
I know. I don't know. You know how you get a block against something and you just don't? That's my issue.
You know, the crazy thing is I had set one up in scheduler, set up SyncToy and scheduler. And whatever reason, I couldn't find it. And so I said, all right, I'll set it up again. So I set up another one. Whatever had happened to that first one, it was really still there. And I had set it up to kick off every 30 minutes.
Oh, boy.
Well, it wouldn't even finish in 30 minutes. Right. So it was you know, never ending. And I finally was able to find it and get rid of the thing. And then I went, you know, to having just the one that was working at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it works great.
Right.
The scheduler works great. I use the scheduler over on my Windows Home server to back up the VMs, actually on the Hyper-V server to back up the VMs to Unraid.
Yeah, it does work well from that standpoint. So, Rich, do you use any kind of synchronization tools in the stuff that you do?
No, I do not. Okay. I'm lazy like that.
And I don't either. One of the things I do recommend, though, for people who, if you are moving data for any reason, and you're moving large amounts of data, especially if there's lots of little individual files associated with them, that you do use some kind of tool like a SyncToy, and it can be anything, to actually manage the file transfer. I think RoboCopy fits into that build or into that idea. Of course, SyncToy would, because I don't know about you guys, but I've had so many problems with Windows Explorer or Windows File Management, moving files and choking halfway through, and then you don't know what got transferred and what didn't. And these solutions do provide a pretty robust transfer methodology that allows you to get all your files from one place to another. And if one fails, it'll tell you, and it doesn't just stop in the middle of it.
No, both of these are excellent with that. And I've had the same problem, Jim, with transferring stuff. And, you know, like you said, I have tons of little files. You know, although I shoot my images in raw format, you know, all the little files that go along with that, and you can imagine 800,000 files, I've got tens of thousands of itty-bitty files. And they're using the Windows transfer always gives me a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell people don't ever move files. Don't ever move files unless it's one or two, or maybe a handful. I don't know. I'm probably being too cautious or maybe over exaggerating.
What I had to end up doing, because I was trying to copy them, and this was not when I was trying to back them up. I can't remember what the circumstances were, but I was trying to copy them somewhere, and then I was going to delete them once I felt they were copied. I kept having so many problems, I couldn't tell what was copied and what was not copied. So I ended up having to just use the move. Because at least with the move, now you know, okay, if it's deleted off here, it has moved itself.
I'm just afraid in the move commands, especially in Windows, if you move it, I'm afraid it's going to get corrupt and as it's moving, and I'm going to lose the file. I don't know. Again, maybe I'm a little paranoid there, but...
No, that's a total pain in the neck. I mean, I have used RoboCopy on a couple of occasions when I'm moving a big chunk of files around just for that reason right there.
Yeah. I just get paranoid because it's – especially if it's something you worked on or a file and something weird goes on in the transfer, and then you know, if it's that split second when it's moving and then something goes wrong. Anyways, that's always been mine. So, yeah, SyncToy's worked well. Whenever I'm – formatting or changing my home server, I'll move files onto a PC. You know, I'll put an external large hard drive onto a PC, and I'll use SyncToy to move all the files over, work on the home server, so I don't run any risk of losing anything, and then bring the home server back up and move all those files back over. So, it's just a good way to do that.
I think I'll try always sync next without doing the look for a change and backup every time. See if that helps. You know, one of the things I do when I take the photos off the compact flash is Lightroom allows you to put it in two different places right from the transfer. So really at that point, as they're coming off the compact flash, I've already got a backup. So I'm getting a little overboard with having this thing sync every time it sees a change.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's for sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, some options there. I think RoboCopy fits in there in that same idea. But if you're moving files around, give those a look, and Mike will look to hear back from you on what you hear or what you find around Always Sync. That's the first time I've ever seen it, so it'll be interesting to hear what you have to say on it.
Yeah, it looks very interesting. I'll let you know.
Good. Rich, last week we talked a lot about antiviruses and antivirus software as well as viruses themselves. So this is a little bit of a holdover from last week, but it looks like you had a problem with the XP antivirus 2011 scareware, is what I know it as, and it tries to get you to buy stuff from a virus vendor that doesn't exist.
It's a scam thing. That it's trying to get you to pop in your credit card number, you know, and then it's supposedly going to send you a fix, which doesn't do anything.
No, it doesn't. They just keep taking it off, taking your credit, your money, right, at that point.
Yeah, I don't really know what they do there because I never gave them my credit card number. Right. And I've actually never been infected. But I have seen, like, probably in the last year, probably about five different computers that I've worked on have had this thing. And basically, by the time this thing has had its way with it, and by the time the computer's made its way to me, But the best I could do was pull all of their user files and maybe go into the app data and grab that, then scan the crap out of it, make sure with like three or four different virus, antivirus or spyware kind of utilities, and then basically either repair or run a reinstallation if that didn't take. Because this thing does a lot of, I was over at my brother's house the other day. I was over there picking up something, some computer parts that I left over there when I was giving my nephew another hard drive. And he says, hey, come on in here. I've got a live one. And it was that virus, actually. He was remoting into a customer's PC, and they actually had a problem with it. And he couldn't run any exes. He would click on an exe. So, he's a pretty smart guy. He goes, I'm trying to bring up Task Manager. Oh, let me see. I'll change it to .com. Mm-hmm. So he did, and it worked,
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this thing is a pain in the neck. You run something like Malwarebytes on it, which is purported to take care of it, and you say, okay, yeah, delete all of that junk, and now let's reboot. And then you come back up and you say, well, okay, let's run another pass, make sure. And I'll be darned, but the same stupid, files are still there, and you run a pass, and it's a really persistent. It's a tenacious little piece of code that's.
It does keep coming back, and you mentioned in the show notes that LimeWire is a torrent, right? That you see kind of in common with some of these things.
Yeah, I think almost every single one of these infections had LimeWire on it. In fact, I got to tell you, a gaming friend of mine who lives down in New York just called me the other day. And actually, I was talking to him tonight, and he's got this on his computer.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we were trying to figure out how he got it. And I says, well, I know I've repaired, friends and family's computers, and they've had LimeWire or FrostWire. And he says, oh, yeah, I got that. I says, Ed, stop doing that.
Stop stealing the free stuff.
Yeah, you know what? Stop stealing the free stuff for one thing. But even without making any judgment on that or whatever,
right?
And geez, don't do it because you're gonna get infected. I mean, this is what these malware authors, that's one of their favorite vectors. It's anything that is a shared file like that, an illegally shared file. Let's call it what it is. It's an illegally shared file, and they infect them, and then you get the malware on your system and your host.
Yeah,
and maybe if you don't know what you're doing, you lose everything. So
right.
Yeah, funny you should mention FrostWire. That's what I found my older son using to download music.
Yeah.
And it's called FrostWire? That's a new one for me.
I think it was FrostWire.
Okay.
There's a FrostWire. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, what I had done, he doesn't know this. He still doesn't know to this day, is I just went into the Untangle, the second part of my super router, and just clicked it where you can't access the internet anymore. So right in the middle of a song he was downloading, it stopped. And after a couple weeks, he finally turn the program off.
Nice. And so from that point on, it was blocked, right?
From that point on, it was
couldn't
blocked.
Get to it anymore.
He has no idea why it stopped.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We've in other circles, we've talked about torrent, based programs. And I think you really got to be careful. But Rich, I'm seeing – it's just funny that you brought this up because I'm just seeing more and more virus infections all the time. And for most people, I say, I'll be honest with you, back up your stuff. We're going to reload. And because those things are getting harder and harder to pull out.
They are. I agree. It's some people say, well, you're copping out. It's like, no, I got stuff to do tonight. We can run this reinstallation and then we get you up running, put your files back on, and then you can go ahead and get all your downloads, your updates and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's just much faster.
I've contended for the last 2 years that the average user on the internet is just screwed for the most part because they don't really know. They know how to get around and get to the net and load some programs and do some stuff. But, you click one okay out there and you're done. One pop-up, it says, something, click okay. And most users are just conditioned to click okay to move on, right? And they're just their host. It downloads stuff and they don't know what to do. They've got to contact their local IT guy and say, I can't, So I just feel for people. I almost want to say, just put in Ubuntu.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the average person, you know, if I bet if I did a poll around the office, the average person doesn't even regularly update their antivirus. You know, they probably bought one, had a subscription for maybe the first year to get the updates. Subscription runs out, and they just – they don't, you know, update it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way they're going to solve it is eventually that machine will get slow or whatever, and they'll go buy themselves a new one. And you know, that's how they're going to get around it.
Or just stop using it.
Yeah, or just stop using it. Exactly. Yeah.
It's just like, no, I don't really do that. I mean, I've got a friend who's got an old laptop, and they just put up with the slowness of it.
Yeah, you know, something else too, somebody was just mentioning in chat. Yeah, a lot of people will sit there with that little yellow shield, you know, saying, hey, I've got updates, Windows updates, and they never install these things.
Yeah.
You know, I pass by people every day that, you know, I look at their computer screens, and it's like, oh. Maybe you ought to click that thing and see what you got there. You know?
I
mean, this is how people protect themselves against vulnerabilities that are like drive-by, where you just open a page and you get infected that way because of some vulnerability some hacker has found, you know, some exploit that was just found in Internet Explorer or whatever, you know. So
I wish they could set it up where when you do the download, you do the update, that you don't have to reboot so often. You know, I'm the kind that I don't reboot so that often, and I leave stuff open all the time, and I hate rebooting. And, you know, like my Hyper-V server, good God, I hate rebooting the server. And it seems like every time it does an update, it wants me to reboot. Mm-hmm. And now I have to shut down all the VMs, do the reboot, bring them all back up. Yeah, it's not that big of a pain, but I really wish they would have just the really big updates where you had to reboot.
Yeah, it does stop people, and I've found individuals who haven't rebooted their computer in a month. You know, and I'm like, really? You don't shut this down at night? And you know, mine reboots automatically. You know, at least once a week with the updates and such. But there's gotten to be so many lately, I just leave it. But a month, really? You know,
well, I'm gonna have to admit, because I'm one of those people who
really
I never turn mine off.
Okay,
and I hate coming in here and finding that it has rebooted on its own.
Yeah,
so I definitely have that turned off.
Yeah, my work PC gets rebooted every night. I just turn it off and reboot.
Well, you know, one of the things, the way we log into work, if I want to work on some files from work, is I remote into my machine at work. Sure. And I never know when I'm going to need to do that, so I actually never turn anything off.
Now, if you leave that, Mike, if you leave that ready to log in, right, so you just reboot it, I assume you have some kind of security login on your PC, right? Yep. You should, through remote access, you should just be able to access that login screen, put your password in and log in, and it should act like it's – you have access to it. So I don't turn it off. I mean, I have a laptop, so, but when I had a desktop, I would just reboot it and then I could get to it. It would just present the login screen to me and I could log in that way.
Yeah.
Well, you just don't like to reboot.
No, because I leave spreadsheets open. I come in.
Yeah, no, that's it. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
As soon as I sit at my desk, I'm going right away.
No, right on. I got you. And I know those kinds of users too. So
I think last time we talked about, I had something like 40 went, Chrome tabs open.
Okay. You know,
so I here at home, not at work.
Yeah.
You know, leave those things running all the time. I just hate rebooting.
Oh my God, I can't imagine that. Yeah. 40.
We're not,
I know.
Podcast.
After a podcast, though, I have a lot of tabs open, but I do find Chrome degradates after a while. If you leave that open for too long with too many tabs, I have found Chrome doesn't respond as well as it could, so close that out and bring it back up.
Yeah. I probably need to do that. I did need to shut down Always Sync because I was right at my RAM limit before we started the podcast.
Yeah.
So I had to shut a few things down. Anyway.
Okay. Quick, Rich, did you have anything else to add there? I think I cut you off.
No, I'm okay. Good.
Perfect. A little, as we wrap up the podcast here in the next few minutes, a little quick word association. So Mike, I'm going to start with you first. I'm going to say a word, and then I want you to tell me the first thing that comes to mind. Okay, you ready?
Oh,
movies.
Aliens.
Aliens. Okay. Rich, movies. What did you think of first?
Well, that's easy now. Rip.
RIP. Interesting. All right. Not what I expected.
But I'm on the server.
No, actually, that's funny that the way you guys associate with that. I think if I asked most people, they may say something like Netflix, right? Because that's how they're getting their movies these days. A lot of folks are getting it through Netflix. So certainly, Netflix has been the demise of a company called Blockbuster that just 5 years ago, right, was probably, if I would have asked that same question to the average user 5 years ago, folks would have said Blockbuster to that question.
Yeah,
if you needed a movie, you just went to Blockbuster. I mean, it was amazing. And now, of course, Blockbuster is in bankruptcy. Yeah. And then was just recently here, Mike, you put in the notes that Dish Network has bought the remaining Blockbuster assets that are available from the bankruptcy hearings or what was left. What was left of them, and they're going to keep 500 of the. They're going to
keep 500 locations. Yeah,
keep 500 locations. The remaining 17,000
and 1700.
Then 1700. Sorry, and you said why on earth would they want these physical locations? Or
are these like in places where people only have dial up, so they can't get Netflix streaming? Or what's going on here?
You know, that would be strategic. I bet it's not. The reasoning is not that strategic, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think as you did the word association, that you know, it's a small sample here, of course, but the Blockbuster name is not even what it used to be. You know, if you're Dish Network, I don't know. Unless you have some other purpose for those locations and just you know want that location and going to get rid of the Blockbuster name, I don't even think the Blockbuster name is worth much anymore.
Yeah, it certainly didn't make it through. Netflix just crushed it when it came from an online and getting your DVDs in them. I remember when Netflix first came out, and I was one of the first ones to join, and people were like, "Get your DVDs in the mail, really?"
Yeah.
You know, and they had a limited. You know, they had a limited supply of DVDs, and there were some issues getting the DVDs to your house, not broken. And, you know, they got that quickly figured out and opened up centers, you know, just about in every major metropolitan city here in the U.S. so that your movies would get to you in a number of days. Netflix has an amazing algorithm that they use that tells them where movies are going to be checked out so that they can ship movies interdepartmental or inner city. That's not the right word, but you know what I mean? From city to city to make sure that they have the right DVDs in the right place. It's kind of amazing, although all that work's going to go away now, I think, as we move to streaming, again, probably in the next 5 years. I don't think anybody will – well, 5 years is probably too short, maybe 10.
The only thing that worries me about that, because I am a big believer in streaming. You know, I think even Blu-ray has a limited life because streaming is the way to go. Is all these caps the ISPs are putting in there?
No, you're absolutely right, and I'm glad you brought that up, Mike, because our friends in Australia have big caps.
Yeah.
You know, and I think even in Canada, John talks all the time about some of his download cap. Rich, do you have a – you don't have a cap on yours?
I don't have a cap, but I have a thought about that,
yeah.
That whole cap thing. You know, it's kind of funny that you think about the United States being, you know – air quotes here, the most technologically advanced nation in the world, yet we're not anywhere near number one in average internet up download speed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that belongs to a country, what is it, South Korea?
I think it is South Korea.
Yeah. You know, so when they cap this, and I understand this is, you know, somebody that's not playing with millions of dollars, you know, responsible for that. But, you know, when they cap, it's because, in my eyes, it's because they just don't want to build a better network that can handle the throughput, you know, the bandwidth, I mean, right? So
and a chance to make more money.
Absolutely,
They're working the model. You know, they're going to work this model until it's dead, and then they absolutely have to upgrade. But, you know, hopefully, you know, my hope there, I'm just end with this, my hope there is that one of the major players still around, you know, that are around today, you know, maybe Comcast or whatever, will make a break to a better overall service, and that will just force everybody else to upgrade their services too. You know,
this is definitely not the cheapest route, but we rent all our movies really through Zune on the Xbox.
Okay.
And you get new releases there. Now you do have to rent each individual movie.
And at how much is that per movie?
480 Microsoft points.
Which is what? What does that equal?
I'm still in shock because you rent them from Zoom, but go ahead. How much?
What is the Microsoft point to real money translation?
Yeah.
It's probably about five.
Put it Google. 480 Microsoft points equal what dollars?
Or
$2. You know how you can convert Celsius to Fahrenheit and you can convert dollars to pounds in Google. I wonder if Microsoft points can be converted to dollars.
Probably. And if you guys find out, I probably don't
know. I think it's $3 or $4.
But, you know, the beauty there is I'm renting a 1080p movie, and it will start playing within seconds of saying play. You know, you go through the list, you have a new selection, and you press play.
So this is better than Netflix quality-wise.
Well, you know, Netflix has high definition. So if you get a movie or a TV show on Netflix that is in high definition, the quality is going to be very similar. The difference is going to be that Zune has new releases. You know, pretty much there probably is a little bit of a delay, but once it comes out on DVD or Blu-ray, it is available on Zune.
You know, it's kind of sad to me that they're kind of killing off the Zune, right? I mean, isn't that what we hear?
Well, the Zune name, certainly.
I think they're killing off the name. They're killing out maybe the hardware, but like this Zune marketplace that Xbox uses, they may just rename it, but I don't think they're going to get rid of that.
Yeah, I hope not, because I'll tell you, you know, I was telling Jim before the show that, you know, I did a deal with my daughter where I gave her a 4G and she gave me her iPhone 3G. Don't ask. And anyway, so this is my first chance to play with iTunes. And I got to tell you, I just hate it.
Mm.
I hate it. It's such a pain in the neck. I don't understand why it works the way it does. And I got to say, you know, flipping that over and looking at Zune, I totally understood how that thing worked. It made sense to me. So there's so many things wrong with the iTunes. You know, if your computer dies, right, and all your stuff is on your iTunes, on your iPod or your iPhone, and you walk up and you install a new operating system and you install iTunes and you walk up and you go to sync it, it says, "Hey, you want to sync? We're going to wipe all your data on your phone. Do you still want to sync?" It's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
of course you should have backups, but, you know, for the average user.
I'm about to delete iTunes off my computer. I never use it. Ever since getting the Android phone, I've never used iTunes again.
Yeah.
But I don't have any purchased music in there, so it's a little easier for me.
And you've never bought from iTunes?
I have never bought a song from iTunes.
Yeah. And you can rip that to a CD and then you know, import it back in, or there's ways around that.
You know, my listening habits is probably quite different than the average person. If I want to listen to music, I'll generally just stream Pandora.
Right. Yeah. Rich, you were going to say something?
Yeah. And if I listen to anything, it'll probably be Pandora. And actually, I was thinking about, you were talking, Mike, earlier about how everything is going to streaming. And you know, when I first got this device, I'm like, well, I'm on the way to work. You know, why don't I download these podcasts and listen to them? And then I got to thinking about it. It's like, why am I filling up my phone? You know, it's just an 8 gig phone. Why am I filling them up with more and more podcasts? Stream them, you know, and it works just as well. You know, so I do like that. You know, that it's pretty cool.
What do you use for on your phone? I'm sorry, Mike. One sec.
No,
Rich, what do you use to stream the podcast?
Oh, my iPhone.
Oh, on the iPhone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's an app.
I'm an iPhone newbie here. You know, my first foray into Apple world. So.
But is there a specific app that you use to stream the podcasts?
I think it's just called the iPod.
Okay, it's the software built into the iPod.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Mike?
I use BeyondPod, and I did streaming for a while, but this may be a limitation of BeyondPod, is it didn't save my place.
Yeah, I got that too.
I have it set up to it just – when if I'm on a Wi-Fi connection, that every 3 hours it'll check and see if there's any new ones, and then it'll download them. And then, you know, I wake up in the morning, oh, look at that, I got some podcasts, and I'll listen to them on the way into work. And when you reach the end of the podcast, it auto-deletes.
Yeah, and I have that set too, and that hasn't been working real well for me. So maybe I'm missing something from a setting standpoint, because I bought BeyondPod last week to do that. Dogcatcher is another one for Android. I still contend, though, Rich, the one you're using is still the best podcasting podcatcher that's out there.
Yeah.
I almost would buy an iPod Touch to listen to podcast on, because it does it so well.
It does a pretty good job. But here's a little glitchy little thing. It's actually, I think it's a software glitch. you go into your podcast in iPod, right? And you say, okay, I see there's a, I'm driving to work and I see, oh, there's a, maybe a new podcast I want to download. So I say, okay, download it. Then I hit the back button or whatever it is, right? What happens? I can't go back to my podcast. I got taken to some marketplace or the iTunes store. And so for me to get back to where I want to go, I have to close out the app and then start it up again.
Yeah.
That's a glitch.
And I think on mine, even on my Touch, I had to sync it to my iTunes player to get those podcasts, to be honest with you.
I don't think it was
an over-the-air because I had a Touch and I didn't have a phone. So the Touch required, you know, my first-gen Touch didn't have any kind of – it had Wi-Fi but no other kind of connection. And it required connectivity to iTunes to get the podcast. So that was a huge limitation. But, yeah. Yeah, I want the functionality that you're talking about. I want it to just download at night. I had mine set at 3 in the morning, and for some reason that's not working. I need to look into that. I want it to download automatically because it's always on Wi-Fi when it's in the house.
Yeah,
and then I want it to delete when I'm done listening to it. I want it to delete it automatically and just have it be gone.
And it's not doing the auto delete?
No, it's not doing that either. So I need to look. Maybe I don't have the settings right. So I don't want to bash it, but it's one of those things where BeyondPod has tons of options, and sometimes you need to go in there and make sure you got them set just right. So I'll need to look. Yeah. I will need to look into that. Yeah, we talked to Rich. So this is like a carryover from last week, Rich. We talked about that as well in last week's show.
Yeah. Well, I have a deal with my daughter. You know, my contract came up. She and I share a plan, and it was time for me to get a new phone. So I bought the 4G, turned around, and gave it to her. And so we swapped it around, you know, and I thought, well, you know, I'm the dad, so we'll do this. And it's my first phone. But, you know, after playing with this thing – the deal is now when her time comes up, I'm seriously going to think about getting the Windows Phone 7.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, if it's using the Zune interface, basically, if it's based around the Zune interface UI and how it works, I'm pretty sure I'm going to like it better. You know, I could be wrong, but whatever it is, I know, Jim, I'll be able to deal with it anyway for a couple more years because it'll be a beautiful phone either way.
It is a nice UI from what I've heard. You're not concerned. They've had some update problems with that phone, and in other words, Microsoft getting the updates to it?
Yeah, well, I've heard that you may have heard this too. I heard that like AT&T, you know, the cell phone companies are holding those back.
Right.
Now,
they may be
going over them and making sure, but – you know, then again, maybe there, you know, I don't know if there's some conflict of interest there or not.
Well, that's what stopped me. I mean, originally when I was, I had a Palm Pre before, and when I was making the move to, I was going to make a move to a Windows phone, and well, they weren't available on Sprint, and I'm a Sprint customer. So I waited and waited and waited, and then I found out, well, they're never going to release them on Sprint, or I still don't think they're out there on Sprint. So I just went with Android at that point. But now I've heard, I'm glad I didn't, even, you know, if I would have had access to it, because they've had so many update problems with them. And I know they're getting that fixed, but it just took them forever to get some of that basic functionality there. And I know it's a conflict between the carriers and Microsoft, and it's not totally Microsoft's fault.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed my Android phone.
That concerns me too, Jim, is Microsoft just doesn't seem to be keeping up with the pace of things, you know, lately.
I'm not sure it's completely Microsoft. They have everything they need. I think it's their they need to muscle those carriers a little bit harder to get this.
Well, yeah, so for
it's
that
not
I would
Microsoft. Yeah.
Yeah, but for that I would hold Microsoft as, you know, responsible. It's like, well, it's your phone. Work yourself a better deal with your carriers so that they will push out yours, you know, your updates sooner so you won't look like a clown, you know, in this really lucrative and competitive market, you know?
And it's a very, very high-profile market that they're in. And you're right, it's making them look bad. And while it's definitely not all Microsoft's fault, you know, you don't get the feel that they have the urgency that they need to have.
I just don't think they're throwing their weight around. You know, they got so smacked around during the 90s with antitrust stuff. I think that beat them down a little bit, and their aggressive tendencies, it beat all their aggressive tendencies out of them. And no doubt in the 90s, they were aggressive. I mean, they wanted every space to be theirs, and that's what made them the giant they are. I just think that they're not as aggressive anymore. They're a little nicer company because of some of those things, and they need to beat on those carriers a little bit more and be more aggressive.
They need to find a little bit happier medium. You know, they've gone maybe too much to the other way.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, I'm a little aggravated that they aren't really getting their act together with this phone, because I mean, I haven't actually used it, but from people, you know, like from Paul Thurrott and everybody else that's talked about it, this is a phone worth looking at. And if they could just get the updates out in a timely fashion, man, I mean, they'd be putting some little bit of hurt on, Apple products. So,
yeah, I think there's a market for them, especially in the business space, because, you know, we started the podcast off with this Office 365. And of course, that's integrated in with Windows Phone 7. And so there are some nice features associated with it. It's a great UI, very easy to use. I think there's tons of business customers today that may still have Winmos, 6 or 6.5 that are holding on for dear life. There's still a bunch of those out there in the corporate environment. And so I think that they just need to get that done. And the longer they wait, the more, you know, Android gets better and the farther behind they get. So they've got to move fairly quickly here.
Yeah, I'm an Android user, but I still have high hopes that Microsoft will turn this around and be a major player, you know, take the number three spot or maybe even better.
Yeah, we really need him to be in the number three spot, right? We talked about this early on, as there's one and two, and we really need Microsoft to push innovation and be the number three spot.
Because, you know, I am a Microsoft fan, and you know, I love my Android phone, but the one thing is it's just not fast enough. I'm always having problems with it. You know, the UI is not fast enough, and that's, you know, partially my fault again that I've loaded so much junk on it. I've got 10 screens of apps.
Reboot.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I don't know when the last time I turned this thing off was.
Oh, there you go.
It's been at least 3 weeks.
Yeah, you should probably every once in a while restart it.
So I guess my reboot hate even goes to
you're a reboot hater. I saw that in chat. That was
I think that was who said that, your wife?
It was my wife. Yeah. So it's but reboot it every once in a while, Mike. You might get a little better performance at it. So reboot, for God's sakes, just close the apps and reboot your PC every once in a while too.
Oh, good gosh.
Well, guys, hey, we've done our traditional hour and 15, and we've had some good topics tonight. I appreciate you guys coming out and filling in on a pinch, and certainly we missed Andrew and Christian tonight. I'm sure Christian's having a bang up time in Argentina, and we were going to try and bring him in live from there, but then at the last minute he bailed out and said he wasn't going to take any tech gear to do that. But that would have been cool, live from Argentina. And I'm sure he's having a good time. Andrew, we hope you feel better.
I'd like to say something about Andrew before we get off.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, I've never looked at the show notes that are on the website until this last week. And so I looked at him this last week. He does an excellent job of doing those show notes.
Oh, yeah, he really does. He's way better than me. So I'm kind of hoping I can talk him into listening to the show and doing tonight's show notes, even though he wasn't on the show.
He has done an excellent job.
Yeah, no, he's very good at that, and certainly the quality of the show notes tripled from me when I was doing them to what he did. And so, Andrew, we do appreciate for that. And he's just got such a great accent, and he's our overseas guy. You know, that's the best part about it.
Absolutely.
So,
and he works for HP.
He does. He does. And so it's good to have his. You know, as we talked about, he always reminds me when we talk about bandwidth that, you know, he's limited. And I got to be reminded of that, because I think I sometimes live in a world of free and unlimited internet. So although CAPS may be coming to a location near you here in the U.S. as well. Let's hope not. Mike, thanks for doing two podcasts in a row. We appreciate that. Rich, thanks for the work on the hard drive, the hard drive sermon, we'll call that tonight.
Yeah, you bet. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and researching.
And we did too. I mean, I learned a lot on that as well. I had no idea that was embedded on the hard drive, and you could just invoke that and use that to erase your hard drive. So it's something I'll have to look into and maybe learn how to do that. So thanks for coming out again tonight, Rich. Good to have both of you. If you want to contact the show, you have questions or comments for what we do out here, and we do this each and every week, 7 o'clock p.m. Central Time here in the U.S., you can join us on live at theaverageguy.tv/live. And thanks to the guys who came out. John, good to see you in chat. tonight. Thanks to the guys who came out and did join us live. You can come out and join us in. Oftentimes we read from the chat, so come on in and do that. If you want to find us on Facebook, you can do that. The Average Guy Network and all the posts that we do out there, I post to Facebook. And you might, who knows, you might even listen to one of the other podcasts and either get the financial one or the fitness one and comment on that as well. Appreciate you guys again tonight coming out. And this will do it for show number 22. And we'll be back here next Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central, for another podcast. So good night, guys. Thanks for coming out.
Good night.
See you later, guys.
Do it in the live show. Listen to this one live. Listen to Windows Home Server live. It does allow me now. I can listen to some others while I'm on the road. I used to listen to Cranky Geeks.
Yes,
if you remember that one?
Yep, that was my first podcast.
I was sad to see that one go.
Yeah, are they done? Did they kill that completely?
Yeah, it's been a while. They killed it a while back.
So I'm in the car with my daughter.
Yeah,
I always plug in the podcast before we leave, right? And so every time she hears Laporte's intro, she goes, "Oh, that's so cheesy, Dad." I mean, she's 12, right? But she knows Leo's. She knows Leo's voice. She knows Paul Thrott's voice. She knows Gina's voice. And so this morning, it was just this morning. It's funny that you mentioned Cranky Geek. So we were playing something, and she looks at me and she says, "Dad, whatever happened to Cranky Geeks?"
Don't you love your kid when they do something like that?
It's just so hilarious. I'm like, I looked at her like, really? Are you really? You're listening?
That is funny.
Yeah. And one time I was listening to the podcast in the living room, and she was reading in the other room or something. And so we were talking, I was listening to the Home Server show. I was going back and re-listening to one of the podcasts that we did. And so she, when we got done, I think Sarah had asked her, you know, what was going on this afternoon. She had been out, and she goes, "Oh, Dad was listening to podcasts, and it was Twonky Media this and Twonky Media that." I just thought that was hilarious. My 12-year-old was talking Twonky Media, so it was.
Yeah, I used to get Cranky Geeks, and I think what was the one Callie Lewis was on before the one she's on now?
Geek Brief was her first one.
Yeah, so I'd get those through the TiVo. So I would watch them on the TV, and the kids would come running downstairs wanting to watch TV and see that would be on. Like, "Oh, Dad." And turn around and run back upstairs.
Yeah, all right. Way to clear the room, Dad.
Yeah, oh, yeah. If I ever wanted to be alone, just put on a podcast.
Yeah.
For sure. And DLTV was another one with Patrick Norton and Heron.
I used to watch that one through TiVo also, yeah.
Yeah, they're not doing...
What is it called? DLTV?
DLTV. I think it would stand for the Digital Life TV.
Those were the guys who got me into doing the folding at home. They had a big folding at home thing.
Yeah.
And that's cool. So I started my own team and didn't get very far, but I started my own team and I eventually killed it. But